This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
So many things going wrong, with more teetering on the edge of collapse. Continuing waves of COVID impact the economy, which has its own deep problems. Storm after storm pummels North America, while Europe gets spring in January. Some countries are bankrupt, inflation rages, war is back, I won't go on. These interlocking threats have been called a polycrisis. If we can't tame them, are we entering an age of permanent crisis? Eric Asadourian has more big-picture experience than most people. For years, he was editor of the influential World Watch State of the World reports. We will ask Eric about polycrisis and permacrisis. But I also want to know about his next stage. Why is he promoting a new green religion? Eric Asadourian, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Are you still in your home base of Middletown, Connecticut?
I am. Yeah, I grew up in Connecticut and then lived much of my adult life in D.C. near World Watch, and returned here to be near my family, and it's a more resilient place, I think, as the climate changes as well.
So tell us about your recent conference in Denmark.
Sure. So I, back in the end of July, joined about 40 other researchers who focus on the polycrisis, on ecological change, on specific subfields. There were chemistry experts and others to talk about the polycrisis. And that is kind of unique in that most of the time, as many said in the conference, we're the lone voice talking about the possibility of societal collapse in a conference. It was quite refreshing from my perspective to actually be able to talk about this very openly without having to convince people that, well, this could be a real possibility, and talk about, well, what do we do about this, if anything?
More people are coming around worrying about next steps in a broken age. Columbia University is again organizing their conference called At What Point Managed Retreat, Habitability and Mobility in an Era of Climate Change. Eric, is it time to retreat, and from what?
I think more of the question is to where. you noted, Europe is warmer. The new numbers came out just today that this was the fifth warmest year in history, in recorded history. Europe had its second warmest year and the warmest summer, which of course we saw having massive impacts on drought, on wildfire, on transportation, energy production. I don't think it's realistic when we have a population that just this last year hit 8 billion people to retreat anywhere. It's certainly important to manage the growth of certain areas. A few years ago, I wrote a little op-ed for the Hartford Courant, the main Connecticut paper, encouraging population growth here, or at least creating space for more people, because as Florida becomes less habitable, as Puerto Rico becomes less habitable, which we saw after their Hurricane Maria, there are relations already here, so a lot of new individuals came and migrated to Connecticut. And Connecticut is a good example because it has such old urban areas that are beautifully built and completely underpopulated at this point that we could actually effectively absorb population, ideally from areas that have been affected by climate disruptions. But that takes, you know, a huge amount of policy planning, as well as, first and foremost, a recognition that the future is not rosy, but that, you know, maybe we'll make it a little bit less difficult by making these technological shifts that are praised so regularly in the media, like electrification, that kind of thing. But really what we need to be doing is reducing consumption, reducing production, and shifting our understanding of what a sustainable and positive future is going to look like.
Well, I think we could say we have to retreat from all-out growth on all fronts. And I want to get on to the fact that most of us picture the focus on threats that are closest to us. I mean, just imagine coping with the never-ending storm track in California these days, and listeners in the West see that as the crisis, even as state hospitals fill up at the same time with the sick and the dying. Talk to us about the ways the elements of a polycrisis interact with one another.
Yeah, that is the trillion-dollar question. I was going to say million-dollar question, but again, I was reading the news this morning, and the newest disaster losses came out just today from Munich Re, and it was another above $100 billion insured losses year, I think $270 billion in total. And in the old normal, there was never a year more than $50 billion until Hurricane Katrina hit. So, you know, the new normal is creating this perma-crisis, this continuing lack of stability that is disrupting economic systems, is disrupting societies, is disrupting localities. Every local crisis means much less resilience and ability to think about helping others far away. You know, COVID really took us away from the ability to really start planning on climate change, even though that would have been a perfect time to really start thinking new as everything was shut down. And there was a brief moment of hope in the climate sector that, oh, maybe we can use this crisis to really go in a better direction. But we saw from the rebound of emissions and the rest of it that that didn't happen. So I'm not sure, you know, what happens? Do we just kind of lose the initiative as we're dealing with wildfire after wildfire after giant flood? You know, this is the third year of La Nina weather, which, you know, is at least partly responsible for the fires in Australia and the floods in Pakistan. So much is changing, and not out of our control, but triggered by us, and now increasingly out of our control, that we're unable to react very strategically. We haven't quite hit that stage where we're starting to make stupid decisions like geoengineering, but it's becoming a increasing clamor in the background, and I am worried that we make those, either we yield those decisions to people who are maybe trying to make profit off of this fear, or are just simply wanting to pursue this as a profitable solution to our climate problems. And that's a real risk, is that people start using the ongoing and growing fear that we have to push us in even worse directions than we're already heading.
Well, in the second part of our interview, we'll come to some of your solutions to overcome those fears, but I want to continue on this track for now. In your January 3rd article, published at resilience.org, you discuss permacrisis. What is that, and how would we know if that has arrived?
Well, that was a new word for me as well. I saw it in the Collins Dictionary, made that their word of the year. And simply, it means an extended period of instability and insecurity, especially one resulting from a series of catastrophic events. So really, for me, after having talked about polycrisis for the last 5 months on and off with this community and in this conference, permacrisis just felt like the culmination of these multiple converging crises, so that we're in that kind of permanent state. Are we there already? I don't know. I think, you know, this is going to take a look backwards from 20 years after the point where we entered a permacrisis, or where we lost kind of the initiative on dealing with these converging crises, to be able to, historians will probably say it better, where this is the point where we just kind of lost control. I hope we haven't gotten there yet. I mean, I know the real challenge for me is that the real positive stuff that people point to as ways that we're addressing this aren't necessarily solutions in the first place, right? So the Inflation Reduction Act is celebrated because it's really going to help the United States electrify and move towards a renewable energy future. But it's very much a consumer future fueled by renewable energy, which is ecologically impossible with the, you know, even just the 300 million of us in America, but then magnified that out to do that in other countries, into Europe, into Indonesia, Philippines, Australia, you know, on and on. All these countries are aspiring to electrify and follow this consumer path. That's just going to hyper spiral us into a perma crisis. And that's not to say, hey, that's so we should enjoy this electrification, and those who haven't done it yet, too bad for you. It's more recognizing that a truly just and sustainable future is a much reduced consumption future with a very simplified level of comfort. That's not to say uncomfortable, but it is, more of a 1970s or 1960s America kind of feel, much smaller homes, walkable, bikeable, maybe more sweaters in the winter and less, natural gas pumping into our homes to keep us warm at 70 plus degrees and on and on. But that's been not promoted for so long that that sounds like the hair shirt environmentalist vision of the future, which is out of vogue right now, and that is unfortunate, because that's what we're going to need to get to if we want to avoid a perma crisis.
Eric, what happened to the World Watch reports, and has anything come along to replace those whole world snapshots?
Well, World Watch, I think, had its life cycle, just like most organizations do, some longer than others. It was actually founded in 1974 and made it all the way to 2017. And, actually was just writing about several luminaries who passed away in 2022, Herman Daly being one of them, and he was on the board for many years at World Watch, and so that got me thinking about it too. But yeah, World Watch, it was celebrated. Those reports were really, I think, influential in drawing attention to the much more holistic interactions between different aspects of sustainability. I think those reports are as important as they were. I think you can point to some variety of reasons why they were less needed, maybe perhaps because there are many more sustainability organizations producing reports now. People absorb information in less book form, unfortunately. A lot fewer people are reading books, as shocking as that is, but true as it is. But also, I think, organizational dynamics were at play, and it was the leadership of the organization that I think accelerated the shortening of its lifespan, truthfully.
So it looks like industrial civilization, which feeds everybody listening here, is actually killing our chances for a survivable future. Should we hope for a big collapse coming sooner rather than later?
It's a key question. And in fact, I wrote on this question after the conference, because that really did come up several times. And I don't have an answer, and I don't think anyone can give a real answer to that, because I'm not sure if you're a science fiction fan, but one of my favorite books is Dune, right? And this is a book that really plays with the sense of time and prescience and all this. And the protagonist actually kind of can see different futures. If we could do that, and we could see, if we encourage collapse faster, does that mean there's more biocapacity left as the dust settles so that we can rebuild and have a better future? Does it mean that, it triggers a nuclear confrontation and kind of ending civilization even faster? There's so many question marks that in the Dune context, it's this, black nexus where you can't actually even know. And I think we're there. There are real reasons why nudging us towards a degrowth strategy much, much faster. Degrowth is not the right word, because that suggests a planned, intentional contraction. But even a unplanned contraction, could that help us to have a better future in the 100-year time frame, because it slowed down economic growth and emissions production enough that serious climate tipping points didn't get hit? And I don't know. I mean, I actually hesitate to answer, because it's so complicated. And no matter which scenario, sooner or later, there is going to be horrific human suffering involved in the transition because of how much we've overshot Earth's capacity, Earth's biocapacity, and how many people there are on the planet. So that's as good of an answer I can give you.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest Eric Asadourian. He's the former editor of World Watch Reports and now an independent researcher and consultant. In our current state, Eric says, a new green religion could help. When did you begin your voyage into a green religion and why?
I think it was a slow, gradual thing and then sudden. So, I actually studied ecological religions back in college and more broadly missionary religions and anthropology and psychology. And so I think my mind was always primed towards the anthropological perspective. In fact, at World Watch, I was writing quite often about how we need cultural shifts, a new cultural paradigm, like Dana Meadows once advocated in systems change. You know, the most powerful way to change a system is by changing the paradigm. And so I really applied that at World Watch to, okay, how do we shift our culture from consumerism, that type of paradigm, to a sustainability paradigm? And worked in that context very academically for a long time as we grappled with this question of, is sustainability still possible and what do we do if it's not, which was the State of the World 2013 topic. I even wrote a chapter on this question of, well, what would a really effective environmental movement look like? And I started painting this picture of, well, it would be a much deeper missionary philosophical movement, right, where you're actually sharing a deeper understanding of the earth, our relationship to the earth, cultural norms around that, rituals, community building, social services, which is a key way of spreading a missionary philosophy. Religion is a loaded word, and I use that now. At the time, I hesitated, especially in the context of a sustainability think tank. But one man's philosophy is another man's religion, right? I mean, Christianity is just a philosophy, but to a Christian, it is the way, it is the truth. So and same with Islam and Buddhism and the rest. So for me, having a philosophy or a religion, which I think really is a philosophy embodied in practice, daily and embedded in community is a way to really deepen one's relationship to the earth, deepen one's way of being an environmentalist. When I was a professional environmentalist at World Watch, not that I'm not professional anymore, but it was really a 9-to-5 thing where we would do our work, we would try to save the world from 9-to-5, maybe have a happy hour, but we wouldn't interact as a community. We wouldn't take on a little bit of babysitting for the colleague who just had a new child or go to someone's dad's funeral or that kind of thing. There was nothing, no deeper community building. And I've seen that in the many organizations I worked with. And I crave that. And I think the environmental community suffers from not having that. So for me, a couple of years ago when I started the Gaian Way, the idea was to really create a deep, eco-centric, philosophical community. Some see it as just a philosophy. Others see it as a religion. And for me, the Earth, or Gaia, is the center. Right? It's without Gaia, which we are completely dependent on, we die. I have a little mantra, which is serve Gaia or die. And that's not to humanize or anthropomorphize the earth. It's just to recognize if we don't subjugate our own will to keeping the earth alive and well, then we don't make it. And that's actually Islam is God's will is at the center, and this is not that way. There's no prayer in that sense of somebody's going to respond to your prayer, but there's lots of meditation, there's fasting, there's ways to ritualize our existence, which is a real part of all cultures, and to feel more connected with this earth and the local systems and the global systems that we are part of and depend on.
You decided to put out a weekly newsletter for people who want to develop their spiritual side in line with natural reality. How did that grow into a community, and how far along is this new green church?
That's a great, you know, practical question. I truthfully did not know what was going to happen. This was 2019, I think June, where I just said, I'm going to just start putting up an essay once a week. That'll keep me focused on this and see if anyone's reading it. And enough people started reading it that I said, okay, I think I can do a newsletter here. And truthfully, in the beginning, I did a little bit of spamming colleagues and friends, including them in my original newsletter. And over time, you know, it became more organic where, you know, some people unsubscribed, new people found it. And as, you know, I think maybe by half a year, in January of 2020, so right before the world really changed and everything became online, we started having some online Zoom meetings. Some Gaian conversations, we called it, and then we started adding some Gaian discussions of different classic environmental literature, of more Gaian-focused readings, to really start building a virtual community, not with the goal of ending it there, because I do really believe that to have any sort of philosophy grow, it has to be more than just virtual, for two reasons. One, I think John Michael Greer makes a great, strong point that the Internet is highly technical and dependent on huge numbers of resources. So the idea that in a polycrisis scenario, everybody keeps getting easy access to the Internet, whether for political restriction reasons or for just simple economic or ecological resource reasons, is kind of naive. So that alone is enough reason to root a philosophy in geography. But also, you know, it's an earth-based religion or philosophy, and it should be locally rooted in real space. So we have virtual gatherings, and those are welcome to all. But we also are slowly building local Gaian guilds. These include forest or nature meditations each week or each month, depending on the local community, and a way to connect with other self-identified Gaians or environmentally minded individuals and get out into nature and connect to one's living ecosystems and the face of Gaia near them, in a sense, you know, the local bioregion that they inhabit.
In a presentation last June at Harvard Divinity School, you were a bit prophetic, I think. You said there's a good chance the hospital system will collapse. Well, right now, there are hundreds of millions of Chinese people sick with COVID. There's no chance they can all get medical care. People are on their own. And the same is increasingly true in Britain and even Canada. Tell us about the example of Turkmenistan and what that paints for our possible future.
Wow, let me unpack that a little bit, because there were a few different elements there. I think if I remember correctly, in the hospital systems, there's two different pieces you're referring to. There's, I am married to a Turkmen woman who grew up most of her life in Turkmenistan, and so she lived through the Soviet Union's collapse. So that was a political collapse, you know, an economic more than, I would say, ecological. But, you know, to have been there and to see how the systems go on with the infrastructures they have, but the cultures change accordingly, right? So you can still open a tap in a house in Turkmenistan and get water. It's just not purified water anymore. So that means everybody's boiling their water. So you have some systems still working, some in a longer state of failure. Hospitals have those older Soviet-trained doctors who can still do a good job, but high-tech medicine like cancer treatment, if you don't have the resources to go to India to do medical tourism or to Turkey, you die. And I'm not being crass about it or flippant. It's just that is the reality there. So I see that is a possibility. If I was in that context, I was talking about more in the longer term. I mean, the systems, if we look realistically at the ecological changes combined with how we're continuing to grow our economies, and our populations are continuing to grow, including being encouraged to grow by economists, by politicians, and the rest. Those all match up to triggering some sort of ecological and resultant social and economic crises. So there will be many hospital systems that fail. I don't think I was referring to, you know, these kind of small crunches on during epidemics or pandemics, which I think are inevitable, but not, this is not failure as much as I was referring to kind of systems breaking down more broadly. And in that context, I was referring to kind of really getting, identifying Guyon's role as sustaining key medical knowledge. You know, the Christians during the Dark Ages were always celebrated with having, you know, kept some key knowledge alive in monasteries. I think midwifery, which has been, you know, is a lost art for the most part in the United States, much more actively alive in Europe. But ecologically speaking, it causes a tiny amount of the damage compared to a hospital medicalized birth, a cesarean section, for example. It's better for the baby, it's better for the mother. So finding those ways to keep that knowledge alive and thriving now, but also keeping that knowledge alive when systems are breaking down and people really need that is what I was referring to in that context.
What is next for the Guyan religion, and how can people find out more?
Well, I think the hope, this is incredibly young, and I do not know exactly what's next. The idea is to invite people to engage with the community, with the ideas, try the practices of fasting during the full and new moon as a way to build personal resilience, as a way to connect with the lunar cycle, which we often ignore because we're mostly inside and because of light pollution and the rest of it. But there are lots of practices that people can connect with, and you can find all that on Guyanism.org. We have, you know, regular monthly gatherings online, and I hope over time people see the value of it and more local guilds grow and more energy spreads into those local communities around the world.
And this may also help to give us a little more hope and peace on the inside where we really need it if we're going to keep going. That's my thoughts on this. We have been talking with longtime World Watcher Eric Asadourian. He's now promoting an Earth-based religion, Guyanism, and you can find out more, as he says, at Guyanism.org, and that's spelled G-A-I-A-N-ism. Eric, thank you for sharing this time with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the really thoughtful questions and spending some time with me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Life is not just about science, is it? Or a grip on the facts? But about choices of what to do with what we know. We must go further than science can tread, into the wild world of humans, art, social contracts, sexuality, the psychology of power, justice, religious beliefs, and so much more. I'm Alex Smith. Hang in there. Thank you for caring about this world.